Hi, my name's Dan and you're listening to the English Faculty Podcast for week 3 of Michaelmas Term 2010, and I hope that everyone listening is in a fine bill of health. This week we'll have an interview with Daniel Wakelin on the subject of his lecture series Medieval Literary Life and Language. But first, Sophie Sater is a third year English student from Emmanuel College, and I went to her rooms to tape her reading three short poems that she wrote. With its images of libraries and librarians, the first poem, called Anthology, seemed perfectly suited to an English faculty podcast. It begins with a quote from Lewis Carroll's Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Anthology. It's a poor sort of memory that only works backwards, the Queen said. Yeah, whatever. Whether you observe your passion or fall headlong into reason's rage, it's like impotent negotiations, 'cause memory is an anthology, and is one thing to remember and quite another to know. I know. Hardback or paperback? It is all one. A slap on the back is a ripped-out page or a scratched-in sign on my spine. You don't need handcuffs to twist a wrist. Nor are columns inked, marked, and archived by a petty librarian always in right sight. Volumes should not be reserved continuously for long periods. Write. Get it. Write the Latin phrase on a patch in the wrinkled vault of your cortex, and all it truly says is, I am. Whether you observe carefully your rage or fall headlong into passion, whichever Erinyae you take as your mistress, it is no longer yours. Replication now lies in the pen's chimeric power.
Sophie's second poem is entitled Puissance.
Puissance. Your scent sprawls on the bed, spraddled, ready to be duvet, ready not to be you. You have debottled yourself of curved glass, and the emittance of burned rosewood is dry and sweet, licorice of lacking firmness. Your usual squeeze-happy frisson at sea-dawn. And gone you are again. Distance nurtures like skim cream. Every place hosts its lactic phantoms, I learn. Luminous your woven shade on the bed, the imprint I follow into the quicksands of once was and back then. Unbearable funnel, bright saline, in the least likely place of all, a violet bleeding heart facing west. Why, or why not, I should ask, the other is an auxiliary verb and, like a light bulb, will lose the fizz. I'm more like dark chocolate on the tongue. No trying to convince, no tear-tongue song, please. No drama, no. So, still so tantalizing, you drawbow coquette? We are all sun-dried, not net-beaten, pastel and fin de siècle, collected and sorted in a set's custom home. Collector as you are, you keep this description tucked tight under your billowing skirts.
And the final poem that Sophie recorded is entitled Departure.
Departure. And so capricious, yes. The night is riding ahead. She, left behind, forages amid lingering warmth for the wild seeds he fed her, force-malting herself and hating the seasonal changes. But coop discomfort is stored away for the timed being. Weary and stale, she crouches, waiting for rain. Say on. Shuffle off. Slings of grass-green turf inside her many-petaled gulp keep her composed.
Thanks very much to Sophie for writing and reading those wonderful poems for us, and if any of you want to hear more, then look out for a new creative writing magazine entitled Via, that will be released in the next few weeks. Also look out for details of a magazine launch that will be taking place on the 16th of November. And if any of you have some creative writing that you would like to contribute, as always, email it to dj267@cam.ac.uk. That's dj267@cam.ac.uk. Now, this term, Dr. Daniel Wakelin has been giving a lecture series entitled Medieval Literary Life and Language, which seems to me to be designed as an introduction for all students taking Part 1, Paper 1. I met up with him in the English faculty to talk about this series, and I began by asking him how his interest in medieval literature developed.
Well, it developed when I was in the lower sixth, or year 12, as it now is, and we read the general prologue of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales as one of our set texts for the A-level exam. And that got me hooked, really. I suppose there were several cues to my interest. One was that I'd grown up living just outside a small town that was medieval in origin and had lots of medieval ruins in it, Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk. So I had curiosity about that. The other one was that I was interested in languages and also in quirky codes and problem solving and puzzles, and the problems of Middle English language provoked an interest in me because there was something to unravel and decode, at first at least. And finally, and I think most importantly, it struck me that reading works which were about 600 years old, I was nevertheless able to connect with the people being described or with the voice of the person doing the describing. Those people seem to come alive, and just as it's always amazing when you go abroad and you get chatting to somebody from a country or culture that's very different, but you realise that actually we can communicate, albeit with hand gestures or with confusion. That's often quite touching. So too with medieval literature, I found it intriguing to see the same kind of questions and concerns and passions there.
And when the Chaucer prologue, when you first encountered it, was it an immediate, this is something that I am interested in? Was there a period of difficulty there?
It was pretty immediate, I have to say. I remember being sent away to go and translate the first 20 lines for homework, and by the next class, having translated about 200 or 300, I was immediately hooked. I wanted to work ahead, so it just caught my imagination straight away. I should perhaps say that I did have some big problems early on with it. I remember being set an essay about the general prologue, which really foxed me. If you've read it, you'll know that it doesn't really have a narrative as such. It's a description of about 30 interesting characters. And my English teacher, Mr. Moore, who retired this summer, actually, he set the question to demonstrate how well Chaucer shows his skills as a storyteller in the general prologue. And I thought I was pretty keen on this text. I thought I was pretty good at it and understood it. And I couldn't work out how to answer this essay question. How does Chaucer demonstrate his storytelling skills? And I went to see him. And he said to me a phrase I've never forgotten. He said, "You just haven't been thinking hard enough." And I was slightly devastated and crushed. But I went away and did think harder. And I think I did okay with that essay. I remember handing it in fact, from my Cambridge interview at Trinity Hall many years ago. And really, I suppose there was also the beginning of my literary interest rather than my local interest or human connection with this literature. I was fascinated by the fact that it wasn't like a novel, wasn't like the forms of literature that I was used to, and that I had to kind of rethink the sort of questions I could ask about literature if I was met with a text that seemed merely to be a description. What would I do with that? And for me, that was then the next intellectual challenge, which I sort of cultivated and became interested in at university.
I think some students might find it difficult to see how you can get from that step, a step that probably most of us have had, of being interested in this literature, onto developing a kind of a rigorous academic interest in it and, you know, being something, I suppose, something like an expert or knowing a lot about it. How do you bridge the gap between the two? What's the best way of going about deepening your knowledge in this literature?
Well, firstly, I'd say that the gap is more perceived than real. And it's a question of a slight degree more knowledge rather than an all or nothing or a sort of 0-1 distinction. But certainly developing further interests is unusual, I suppose. I took the early medieval option in part one as my sort of language option and became, you know, sort of further intrigued by that. Then I think I stumbled into research in this area almost by accident. I was actually thinking about working on quite different things, on Elizabethan literature or on contemporary poetry, actually. And then I just happened to find a project or two and a couple of questions that I wanted to answer in my third year at university. and I applied to stay on and pursue them. I was always a little bit reluctant. As a new graduate student, I hated telling people that my specialism was medieval literature. There was this sort of pariah status. People thought that I was some sort of, you know, religious sort of freak and obsessive, pedantic person.
And at least here, you're quite a bunch of outcasts. You're sort of a small group set aside if you're the post-grad medieval students. Is that fair?
It felt to me like that then. At that time, there was... In fact, I was the only person doing a PhD in medieval literature in my year of the PhD programme. Now, happily, there are about three in each year. The numbers have increased. But I did feel like I was some sort of oddity for choosing this path. And for me, the key point to remember is that it's part of English literature. It just happens to be old. I've always thought of myself as a literature scholar rather than as a medievalist.
So now that you're here and you're giving this lecture series, what would you say it's about?
Well, the lecture series sprang out of questions that people often had in supervisions. It occurred to me that as much as learning about medieval ideas of chivalry or medieval religious beliefs, what one did need to know to understand the literature were just very few basic points about its dissemination, its creation and reception. People would often talk about the fact that Chaucer had borrowed passages from other works, about him stealing material and plagiarising, and I thought, it's important to realise that to them there were different kind of standards of accuracy, of originality, of honesty in citation. Or people would talk to me about the way that works were read, and I would have to say, well, hang on, did you know that these things were often read aloud to each other? How does the work operate if you think of it as a pattern of sound rather than an image on the page? Or people would comment on the punctuation, say, look at this significant comma here, and I would say, but that's been added by the modern printers. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to package very quickly lots of information that I certainly know it took me years to pick up on through being a graduate student and doing research. You know, it took a long while to gather in all of that information, and I thought, hang on, we could speed this up. So my aim was firstly to offer some of that, I think, quite basic information in a pithy form, and then to think about the significance of it, and in particular to explore what those basic factual differences begin to tell us about the way that texts from this period of time work. They operate upon the reader in different ways, they take different shapes, they have different jobs to do in some cases, and I wanted to explore therefore the implications of these differences in ideas of authorship, in reading habits, in the technology or materials of books. And hope that people could see that these topics were not just basic facts you had to grub up on to get started, but provoked further questions. In particular, I always think it's good to start off your undergraduate studies with medieval literature, because there are some literary forms and genres, there are some habits of writing and communicating that seem very different from those which our current literary culture encourages. And I know that there's a lot of variety in contemporary literary writing. We have all kinds of avant-garde movements, especially here in Cambridge, with the Cambridge poets, who sort of offer a kind of challenge to other forms of contemporary poetry. But actually, most poetry now is of a certain kind of limited length. Most long prose works are imaginative fictions. There is some non-fictional writing that is artful, but not actually that much. Drama tends to take a certain kind of shape, and with either the one-act play or the two-act play, and tends to have certain kinds of subject matter. And reading medieval literature, perhaps because of its different institutional situations, its different methods of production and reception, for those reasons, the literature that results is very different, and I find it a kind of salutary shock to start off one's study of English literature in general by thinking, hang on, the novel, the sonnet, and the Shakespearean tragedy are not the only models for making literature. What would happen if you had a poem of 2,000 lines which seemingly lacked an ending, as Chaucer creates, or a fiction that was written in verse, or a play that was part of a sequence of 48 plays, all of which told a connected and yet somehow disconnected story? Mm. And I find it challenging to go back to medieval literature, which doesn't have, in fact, the kind of restrictions that contemporary literary culture, you know, with its habits of publication in certain formats, its habits of reviewing, seems to have.
It seems like a lot of the individual lectures are structured around critical distinctions that you want to collapse or make a bit more fluid than is generally recognised. We get a lecture that's looking at the distinction between the oral and the literary, between literary language and plain language, between useful and useless words. How do these distinctions work their way into the critical vocabulary, and why do you find it appealing to break them down and try and challenge our perceptions of them?
Well, firstly, why do they work their way to our critical vocabulary?
I mean, by that, trying to say that you're trying to suggest maybe that the distinction between literary and oral is completely separate, that's not the best way of looking at this literature. Mm. So why, how have we ended up talking like that?
Well, partly it's for critical convenience. We tend to sum up, to generalise as we read things, and that helps us to make sense of what we're encountering, especially when we're on an undergraduate course where we read, you know, umpteen works a term. You need to have some way of categorising and of sifting out. When you first begin doing close reading or practical criticism of texts, it helps to be able to identify high style and low style, or plain and literary language, fairly quickly as a rough guide to yourself to begin to form critical judgments. So there's a sort of necessity there. Also, many of them spring up over our assumptions, and lots of the terms that I look at are, in fact, not especially jargonistic or specialised, maybe oral, perhaps, but if we called it spoken and written, mm-hmm. then oral and literate language are not really specialised terms. Plain style, high style, or plain or literary language. We use these judgments, I think, as general readers as well, and as general people discussing the cultures that we encounter. And it occurred to me that with that casual vocabulary, which is often the best vocabulary that we might use as critics, there do come, unfortunately, some casual assumptions that we need to upset. Oral and literate is perhaps the one that I can talk about most clearly, because I remember myself having my assumptions shaken up about this by a particular book that was published in 1997. And when I became a graduate student, I was sent to read it in my first week or so, in fact, by Dr. Beadle from St. John's. And it's Joyce Coleman's Public Reading and the Reading Public in Late Medieval England and France. And she began her work as a folklore expert and anthropologist. And she was enraged, as many people who work in the Third World are, by the way that we categorise oral cultures in sub-Saharan Africa mm-hmm. or in South America as being ignorant, stupid and whatnot. And she led me through the anthropological literature, which revealed the ways that, in fact, very few cultures are entirely oral or entirely reliant on written sources and written resources. So I began to see the ways that our judgment, that our critical terms that allow us to make simple judgments are as confusing as they are enlightening. And so I wanted to introduce these terms that we might unthinkingly use. We might see a medieval lyric and think, oh, it's a song, it's for singing, it's simple. We know what we think about that. We know what we think about folk songs, ballads, or whatever. And to say, well, actually, how much does this song rely on writing? How much do our written works also, then, paradoxically, rely on ideas of voice and of spoken language or of presence? So in that lecture, for example, I drew on some research I did into manuscripts of medieval lyrics and carols. And from studying the manuscripts, you could see that these things that look so much like folk songs or popular songs were transmitted by written copies. That's not to say they weren't sung. They clearly were meant for singing in many cases, though maybe not all. But they were also transmitted in writing. They had written conventions of page layout, for example, something that seems rather pointless if you think about the way that we transmit pop lyrics on the internet now in casual and muddled forms. And I thought, hang on, writing and singing here are interdependent in some funny way. It's not an all or nothing. And so I wanted to show students that they have those good terms available already, speech or song and writing, literary style or high style and low style or plain style, but that if they're going to use those terms, they have to be willing then to break down those oppositions and to play with them in some ways and test the ways in which they overlap, they interact and so on.
You do quite a good job of suggesting that the writers of the medieval period themselves are also engaging in this kind of process that Chaucer or Langland or a variety of the anonymous poets that you look at are engaged in thinking about these distinctions and how you can play with them. Do you think that the medieval culture is particularly rife with this kind of playing around with genre forms?
I wonder. I would be wary, partly for annoying people who have special interest in later periods, of saying that it's especially rife with these sort of games, with these distinctions. I suspect that we'd find something similar if we thought about modernist and postmodernist writing. And actually, looking back, now I cast my mind through things, probably in most periods. But I do think that in the Middle Ages, in the late Middle Ages in England, there is a large amount of play with these kind of distinctions. To write literature in English at all is, in the 14th century, not brand new. There were works in English before that, but it's new that it's taking place, on a large scale. And I think there's a tremendous sense of experiment and excitement. I mentioned the kind of different sorts of literary genre or form that one encounters, but also people are, for the first time, thinking, the language I speak at home, that could become something written. And that's there is therefore a transition or experiment underway as they go along in terms of forging literary language. English was very much the third class language in 14th and 15th century England, at least until the end of the 15th century. And so to use it at all, writers had to rethink almost every time they began a piece of work, what kind of style should it be? There weren't the same inherited styles yet, or the same inherited attitudes towards authority, for example. So I think the novelty of creating English literature did force people into rethinking the ingredients of literature, the styles, the oral or written elements, the attitude, the kind of reading that is implied or invited. Other poets and other writers across time have done that. And Ezra Pound, for example, springs to mind, actually, as somebody who tries to shake up what the ingredients of literature should be like. There might be others, perhaps people now working in digital media, for example, though I don't know enough about their work to draw direct comparisons, but that seems a possibility. So perhaps the conditions are productive for this kind of experiment in the 14th and 15th centuries, but I wouldn't want to condemn other periods to say that they lack that excitement.
Your series also seems to suggest that although there isn't a wide body of what we'd now call primary critical material on these literary texts, there are still ways that we can find out what it might have been like to be a medieval reader encountering Chaucer, encountering Langland. I found the marginalia of John Shirley that you draw our attention to particularly useful in this regard. How do we go about discovering what it was like to be a medieval reader?
Well, this is a question that's concerned me a lot. I have a kind of a research interest in uncovering what medieval readers did. A lot of my research involves rummaging around in the libraries here in Cambridge or in other places in Britain and indeed overseas, gathering people's marginalia on the books that they read and trying to work out what they were thinking, what they were doing when they read particular works. And of course, that's always going to be a patchy picture. There are problems of evidence. We only know what they wrote about. So in some senses, we're studying their writing rather than their reading. But that's also then a kind of an opportunity. And as you say, there isn't the established culture of reviewing or of literary criticism for English at that time, though there are certainly critical commentaries on Latin works and a few on French and Italian as well. But there is, in the writing of readers in the margins of books, a lot of comment on texts, or even comment which ignores texts, which is interesting in itself. I think often what we find in people's marginalia, we might consider misreading or misinterpretation by our own judgments or standards, and that's a salutary shock. Oh gosh, maybe when you read Chaucer, the fun bits are all of the sexist jokes, things that most of us now find a little bit annoying. To a 15th century reader, they seem to have been tremendously good fun, and that's a kind of wake-up call that we have to remember how surprising the ingredients of these texts are. We might be looking at things that we find interesting, but that the earliest readers did not. That's not to say that we should just duplicate their judgments. I never offer, for example, early readers' marginalia or early readers' comments on other works as a prescription for what you should think now in the 21st century. We are just as entitled to make our judgments as they're entitled to theirs. I don't hold any truck with the concerns that that's an anachronistic response. Mm-hmm. Well, what response isn't? And to write a comment in a margin of a book a week after Chaucer finished writing it is already to be at some distance from Chaucer's own words. So we're just in, it's a difference of degree, if you like, rather than of condemning our judgments or indeed condemning theirs. So I find that evidence thought-provoking, if not the last word on the matter. And also, as I said, because this literary culture is quite unfamiliar in its institutions, in its habits of thought, for example, about what it means to become an author and to declare one the importance of one's work and of one's identity as the maker of it, it's hard to recover their thoughts. We can try to reconstruct them from the notes of readers and also of other writers who often comment quite explicitly on their own texts. It's quite rare, I think, in contemporary literary practice for, say, novelists to tell us what they think they're doing in their novels. Sorry, for them to tell us what they think they're doing within the covers of their novels. They do it, of course, in interviews and in newspaper articles or whatnot, but seldom within the work itself. Interestingly, medieval authors often do comment on their own procedures, on their own intentions, which therefore can, if you like, offer a kind of direct sort of criticism to tell us about literary culture, with the caveat that they were self-aware enough to know that they could lie while doing so, and they almost send up their own procedures on occasion, or mislead us and play games with that for all manner of intellectual and indeed sometimes social reasons.
And a part of trying to understand what it might be to be a medieval reader is to work out what these texts would have sounded like when they were spoken aloud. So there's a lot of reading aloud in your lecture series in what is sometimes called Sidgwick Avenue English. How awkward is it for us to reconstruct the sound of these texts?
It is, of course, very awkward, really. But happily, lots of the research on this was done in the early 20th century by philologists and experts in the history of English, many of whom, in fact, went on to be things such as code crackers as well in the Second World War. So these were people who were experts in unravelling difficult problems. I have to rely on their research. I've not re-researched that topic, but they left fairly good accounts of what they thought Middle English sounded like. Then there were recordings made by them and by their colleagues. In fact, the Cambridge University Press Bookshop on the Market Square in Cambridge still sells, now in CD form, recordings by some lecturers in Cambridge in the 1970s of various Canterbury tales in what we think is Middle English and what we call Sidgwick Avenue English, after the old address of the sort of lecture rooms here in Cambridge. And when I first began studying it, in fact, when I was in my last year at school, before I went for an interview at Cambridge, I remember thinking, would I need to pronounce this Middle English? Of course, that's no requirement at all of any Cambridge interview, but in some odd way I thought it might be at the time. So I actually learned to do it then, right, from reading up about it and listening to, well, then cassette recordings. And so I've continued my interest since then. The reconstruction was difficult for the early scholars who did it. There are very few works, but there are works from the 16th century in which people comment on changes in the pronunciation that had befallen English in their lifetime or in the lifetime of the older people they knew, mm-hmm, in particular. And luckily, it's unlucky in some respects, it makes the text a little odd-looking, but luckily people wrote Middle English almost phonetically. Not quite, but almost phonetically. So it seems that we can trust their spelling as a guide to their pronunciation. That's why, for example, we know that the people who ride on horses and rescue fair damsels were called knichts, not knights, as we now say. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have written the K unless there was some reason for that. It got fossilised later in print. So from the spelling, people reconstructed it, also from the rhyme words, and finally also from remembering that English had descended ultimately from the same root as German. So we could kind of work back and other sort of northern Germanic languages, so we could work back English's history till we attained something that was a bit more like German and other European languages. And by this variety of processes, people reconstructed Middle English. But it is, of course, conjectural. I mean, I do my best, and I've had to learn it from other people. Mm-hmm. But if you like, we could have it all completely wrong. Maybe some horrific trick has been played on us all, and they sounded just the same.
And my final question. I'm always interested when you get these different lectures that seem to be on different topics that are brought into a series, to think about what the general thesis might be, if there is one. And here I think I can detect one, which is probably involved with the sort of critical terms that are bound up in the title of literary life and language. Are you trying to argue that medieval literature can't be boxed off or separated from the life and culture that it came from, that the two enterprises are, in fact, richly interconnected?
To some extent, yes. But I think it's important to... I've called them important to think about the title almost exactly and pedantically as medieval literary life and language. And there are other ways of talking about medieval literature in relationship to life with a capital L in general, mm-hmm. in relation to the political ideas or the religious ideas or other social attitudes of the time. And that is fascinating, I think, to consider reflections of the chivalric ethos or whatever it might be. But I did, in these lectures, want to sidestep that kind of political historicism, that emphasis on the political historical context and social historical context, and think about the history of literature and of its language as well. People often say this of Shakespeare, that we've historicised his work in every respect except in respect of his language. I think it's Jonathan Hope, the expert on Shakespeare's English, who said that, that we focused on Shakespeare's reflection of gender roles in Elizabethan England and interest in the monarchy and so on, but we've forgotten to historicise what English was like then, what it meant to publish, to print, to write plays and so on. Happily, in Shakespeare studies, that's been remedied. But my original impetus for these lectures was to bring in some of the historical background to literary production. So a very narrow area of history, if you like. It ignores the lives of the millions of people who had little to do with literature and lived in pretty bleak conditions. I have to admit it's slightly myopic then to have a lecture series on this topic. But I do think, nevertheless, that within the history of literature, you do need to have some knowledge of the history of literature here in order to understand that literature. And it can be fairly minimal, just to know a little bit about how it was circulated, how it was read, what the language was like, what the connotations of words were. Just as you would want to check in the Oxford English Dictionary the meaning of any particular word that you'd hinged your essay on, mm-hmm. whether it be from the 1910s, maybe it was a slang term at the time, or from the Elizabethan period. So you need to think about language in general as having its own history. Was it prestigious to use English? Was it or not? Was it understood to be a language that was evoking speech, or was supposed to have the reliability, the trustworthiness that we think we've given to printing and writing? So there is an argument there that you need to know a little bit about these things. But I suppose, so that was the first argument, but in a way the second one was that point I mentioned about uncovering the experimental nature of the 14th and 15th centuries for literary production, that everything, all was to play for, everything was up in the air. English literature could have turned out in all manner of other ways. It could have turned into a kind of song-based culture, as mm-hmm. in some cultures around the world. It could have been focused on a very kind of formal diction, as in, say, 16th and 17th century France, especially 17th century France. Or it could have been focused on serving religious purposes solely, without the secular element. Or it could have been focused on reverence for the author as this sort of unimpeachable authority, rather as in the Latin culture of the 14th and 15th centuries. And I wanted to show that those things are all up for grabs, and to show the writers experimenting in that way. In fact, that second point or argument only really developed, I remember, when I first started planning the lectures, mm-hmm. gathering the material together. It sort of occurred to me that there was a story here about pioneering, if you like. And I hadn't expected that. I had the sort of more practical purpose in mind when I began. And then I started to see a narrative emerging within the lectures as I began to plan them, and then went back and kind of tried to sharpen some of that. I think if I were ever to rework them in another format, I would bring that sense of pioneering spirit, that narrative of experiment, to the fore a little bit more.
Dr. Daniel Wakelin, thank you for being on the English Faculty Podcast.
Thank you.
And Dr. Wakelin's lecture series, Medieval Literary Life and Language, will be taking place every Thursday at 10 o'clock in Lecture Block Room 1. That's your lot for this week, so thanks to Dr. Wakelin and Sophie Sater, and thanks most of all to you for listening. Cheerio!